Okay, then. So we're having a series of seminars on the suprapersonal thoughts over a number of weeks. These are based on Subhuti's and Bhante's conversations they've been having over a number of years. Subhuti's a very senior order member in the Triratna Buddhist Order. Bhante Sangharakshita founded the order 40 years ago, over 40 years ago. So at the last 3 weeks, we've been looking at the threefold path of ethics, meditation and wisdom. And I've just written it up here. Sila, Samadhi and Pranya. That's ethics, meditation and wisdom. And this is one of the most essential formulations of the Buddhist path. Everything within Buddhism could be put in here. In the first week, so that was 3 weeks ago, Subhadramati was looking at sila, ethics. Then last week, Silapia was looking at samadhi, and then we're going to have a look at pranya this week. So the Buddha's insight 2,500 years ago, he saw that the source of our unsatisfactoriness, the source of our unease, disease, is clinging to a belief of a fixed and separate self. And he saw that there was a reality beyond this, and this is what we're calling a suprapersonal force. It's beyond the individual, and it's felt as if something is working through you. So all Buddhist practice is trying to get us to go beyond self. There's a root delusion of a fixed and separate self that we want to protect. We want to grasp things that try and support this sense of self, push things away that threaten ourselves. Then, so this is the root delusion which conditions our mind, our mental events, and then our mental events conditions our actions in the world. So within the Buddhist tradition, ethics, meditation and wisdom is used to undo those three aspects. Ethics works on our actions, on our everyday actions, what we do. Meditation works on the mind, on our mental events. And wisdom works on the root delusion itself, the root delusion of self. So just having a quick resume of Subhadramati from 3 weeks ago. She was talking about sila, ethics. I don't know if some of you who were here, I don't know if you remember, she led a really interesting exercise where she brought to mind, or rather asked everyone here to bring to mind, a time when they were unkind. And then just noticing the effect of bringing that to mind had. And likewise, bringing to mind an example of when you've been kind, and then noticing the effect it has on us. And I think one of the things I noticed particularly is that I noticed the effects immediately. I noticed when I brought this example of when I was unkind, immediately there was a sort of sense of unease in myself, a tightening. This general sense of unease. But when I'd been kind, I just had a sense of a clear conscience, I had a sense of joy even. It was very noticeable. So I think that's Buddhist ethics is very much based in our psychology. It's very much based on what helps us to be happy, healthy human beings. So there's three levels, one way of looking at it, there's three levels of ethics for ourselves. It can make us... It makes sense to practice. For others, so we're developing empathy for other people. And there's also a level of spontaneous ethics. And this is what the Buddha experiences. And it's not like he has to try. It's just something that comes very, very naturally to him. He's very other-regarding. He imaginatively identifies with others all the time. So he's just acting spontaneously. We see it as compassion. We interpret it as compassion, but he's just acting. This is just his natural way of being. So Subhadramati was saying, as we mature, we realise our actions have consequences. And she was just drawing out that if we really knew the consequences, why would we act in ways that cause ourselves and others pain? Just stands to sense. If we've got the awareness there, then why would we act in that way? So she was talking about karma, and karma meaning action, volitional action. And the fruit of our karma is karma vipaka. Quite often karma is a misunderstood word. And it's often karma and karma vipaka is mixed up. So everything arises in dependence upon conditions. Subhadramati touched on the niyamas. We're going to have a look at them later, and I touched on them 4 weeks ago. But we're especially interested in the spiritual life, looking at the karma and dharma niyamas. And the implications, so particularly karma, the karma niyama, the implications Subhadramati drew out, is that you can't say, well, that's your karma, sort of in a blaming way. Because of the niyamas, there's lots of different conditions that condition our experience. We might have a headache, and that might be due to all sorts of conditions. It might be a biological one, which is a virus. We might have knocked our head. It might be a psychological knot inside us. Our mind, our mental events are also actions. So the Buddhist model would definitely see our mind as actions as well, not just our speech and our physical actions. And we can notice the effect it has on us. If we replay arguments to ourselves, we notice that it has definitely a physical effect on ourselves. We might even go and have another argument based on the fact that we've been running that round. And also, she was drawing out that we create our world. The person who goes into the room with a friendly, open, smiling face is more likely to be joined with other people responding smilingly. And likewise, the other way round. If you go in with a scowl, people will back off a bit. So we do create our world that we go into. Maitra Bandhu talks about enchanting the room before you're going in. And the fourth implication is that it's part of a natural system. So it's like the law of gravity. The law of karma is just as natural as the law of gravity, but maybe we don't see it just as easily. The Buddha didn't invent the law of karma, and it operates whether you believe in it or don't believe in it, whether you know about it or not. Subhadramati was saying that's how... Where she wanted to know the law of karma as deeply as the law of gravity. We know the law of gravity from a very early age, but somehow the law of karma is more difficult to really get hold of. But according to Buddhism, it's something as fundamental. So we can have a training in ethics where our minds are refined and our ethical sensibilities are refined, our minds become more sensitive, and our conscience becomes clearer. So these are the effects of practicing ethics. Then last week, Silapir looked at meditation, samadhi. And he was saying that samadhi has a spectrum of meaning, anything from meditative concentration or absorption that we might experience on the cushion, to the direct apprehension of reality, all the way up to what the Buddha experiences. So starting at one end of the spectrum, samatha, literally means calming down. It's when our energies are integrated, our emotions and our thoughts are integrated, and we're more alive to our experience. It's an enriching experience. We're developing continuity of awareness, and we're stilling our mind. With mindfulness, we're developing clarity and purpose, and with the metta bhavana, we're developing a warm-hearted, open-hearted response to life, towards ourselves and others. As I was saying before, interest, independence upon interest, arises absorption. So So interest is key in meditation. The more we can be interested in the breath, in ourselves and other people, then the further, more absorbed we will be in meditation. And eventually we might go into a state called the dhyanas or the jhanas. And this is these arise when our mind becomes still and we experience a very still and spacious, expansive states of mind. He talked about the samapatis, and these are attainments or experiences we might have in meditation. And these might be of one of expansion, clarity or peace. We might even get experience of light or sound, or even scent, smells. And these, he's saying, are clues to the mind becoming more refined. And they indicate our awareness is growing. And so he's saying these aren't things to grasp at, but they give an indication of we're going in the right direction. And then he talked about vipassana, which is insight meditations. So when we've developed shamatha, we've developed more of a still mind, an aware mind, open-heartedness, we can begin to introduce contemplation. He called it a contemplation on impermanence, not so much thinking about impermanence, but a contemplation of. And something in us may respond. It's maybe a sense of truth or significance. It's like our whole being responds. We might have a sense of the mystery of life, a sense of wonder. Or we might just wander outside and just see something like a leaf falling, and something will drop, the penny will drop, of what impermanence is. And this, well, vipassana meditations are used to cultivate wisdom. And so we're going to be having a look at wisdom after the tea break. So let's stop now and have a cup of tea, and see you after the break. Let's make a start. So pranya, the third of those words on there, the third of the threefold path, wisdom. So when the Buddha sat underneath the tree 2,500 years ago, he attained what we call enlightenment. And one of the first ways that the Buddha described this was conditioned co-production. It can be understood conceptually as conditioned co-production, although the experience itself is beyond words, it's beyond concepts. So everything within Buddhism is always trying to point towards this experience of the Buddha. So although concepts are very, very useful, got to be a bit careful of tripping ourselves up with them. But it says all things arise in dependence upon conditions. And when those conditions cease, that thing ceases itself. So this is it's the fundamental concept within Buddhism. And all of Buddhism can be unpacked from this. It may seem nothing very much to you, but if you reflect on it long enough, the truths will arise out of Buddhism. And from this, back in the 5th century, Buddha Gosha developed a system of the five niyamas, and these are laws governing the processes. So he's looking at how conditioned co-production works at different levels within the universe. And he found five different levels. And this is something Bhante Sagarachita has taken. And we did look at it a few weeks ago on the very first lecture. But we'll just cover it very quite briefly. The first level at the bottom, Utu, covers the physical inorganic matter, and this is the realm of physics and the realm of chemistry. So this is all the conditionality, it's all the laws of gravity, the laws of thermodynamics, etc. It's all covered within this Utu Nirma. at the next stage up is the Bijanirma. It's a bit more complicated, and this is everything to do with organic living organisms covered by biology, botany, etc. All life is covered in this one. A bit more complexity, and the next level up is the Manonirma, and this is for all life having sensory perception. So it covers things like fight and flight, all the things, all the sort of basic psychological processes are contained in those. So a lot of those first three are contained in the sciences that we've got in the West. But the top two are the ones we're particularly interested in as, you know, in Buddhism, in the spiritual life, the Karmanirma and the Dharmanirma. And the Karmanirma we've been looking at in the last couple of weeks, particularly to do with ethics, but also to do with meditation. So this is the law of karma, where actions have consequences. And we've looked in quite a detail with this. So it's that, you know, we work on ourselves in with this level. We work on our actions, and this refines our consciousness, refines our ethical sensibilities. And then the Dharma Nirma, and this is, this is how Buddhas arise. So Buddhas arise don't arise just through randomness. They arise through processes, through laws. And it's this whole process how a Buddha would arise. And this is the area of prajna, the area of wisdom, and also aspects of meditation as well, as we've seen from Sila Pia a couple of weeks ago with Vipassana meditation. So what the Buddha saw is that we've got this root delusion of belief in a self. And he's saying if you can let go of this self-clinging, then something new arises. Something new arises in our experience. And it seems to be outside of us, something greater than us. Even you could imagine it as a greater consciousness. But within us, it leads to greater creativity, a greater sense of freedom, fearlessness. Even we lose the fear of death. The Buddha just doesn't fear death anymore. He's gone beyond it. When you go beyond the sense of self and ego, well, there's nothing to protect. You don't want to protect it anymore, and you can just let go. And a sense of connectedness with the whole universe. And along with that, an upwelling of joy, of bliss, ecstasy. So all the Buddhist tools, all the concepts, all the symbols are trying to help us to have this experience. And the Buddha permanently experiences, because he's seen through the ego, he's seen through the delusion of a fixed self. And it's something we can have flashes of. So there's an analogy of this, and it's a whirlpool. You can imagine a great ocean with whirlpools in it, lots of vortexes spinning away, and ships would just try and avoid this area of the sea, of the ocean. But you can imagine this is a metaphor, an analogy for ourselves as well. So they're manifestations of energy. They're always changing and flowing, but the boundaries aren't fixed. The water flowing in a whirlpool will be in the whirlpool and then flow out, etc. And eventually a whirlpool will arise and depart. But we tend to identify with just one whirlpool, with just ourselves, as it were. But instead we can imagine, or we can actually experience identifying with the whole ocean. And so this analogy is looking at the same thing. And, you know, we tend to identify with this, you know, just one part of the spectrum of life, but actually there's a whole coloured, lots of coloured lights there. You know, we just identify with the colour orange, but actually there's a whole lot of spectrum that most of the time most of us aren't seeing. And so if we let go of this identification with the self, separate self, all the positive qualities of creativity, of fearlessness, freedom arise. Just going to read a little bit. If you haven't seen this book, this is a very good book. I've read the first two or three chapters. It's called Living Wisely by Sangharakshita. And he's looking at Nagarjuna's Precious Garland Sutra. So he talks about going beyond the self. And sometimes I can find myself getting a bit tripped up with this and thinking, what is the self, and what am I trying to go beyond, and what does transcending the self mean, etc. So I really like this bit here. He says, the language we use can be less than helpful when it comes to the ego, so the ego or the self. Expressions like transcending the ego create a lot of confusion by apparently fixing something non-existent in the form of an apparent object of knowledge. The result is nonsensical. We talk of getting rid of something that never existed, or even denying this object of intense interest and concern any reality at all. The ego, we say, is not real. If we're not careful, we can spend a lot of time talking about something that does not exist, in such a way that it becomes more real to us than it was before we started making so much of it. So he's suggesting another way of looking at it. So he suggests that you are functioning as an ego when you are closed in on yourself, when you shut yourself off from other people. When you are more outgoing and expansive, on the other hand, when you are engaging with the concerns of others, you are functioning from non-ego. These are two very different experiences, one reactive towards the self, the other creative. In a reactive state, you feel cold and hard, as though there's a tight little ball inside you, or as if you are constantly circling back on yourself. But in a creative state, you feel free and open, expansive and flowing. So he's saying it's not as though there's anything called the ego that you have to worry about having or getting rid of. It's rather there's a more satisfying way of living. I really like that. That it's not so much we've got to get caught up with what the self is. We've just got to find a more satisfying and enriching way of living. So instead of saying that the ego does not exist or that it is not real, you could say instead that to be constantly turning in upon yourself is not the most satisfying form of existence. There are better options available to you. Instead of saying to yourself, just drop the ego, you can say, let yourself open up a little, or even let yourself go. So I really appreciated some of that way of looking at things. Letting go of self, letting go of self-clinging, and just having this more enriching, a satisfying way of life. And this is partly where, you know, when we look at our ethical life, we're looking at our very much our experience. We're seeing what works, as Subhadramati was saying a few weeks ago. It's very much something very practical. So and this fixed sense of self is something very deep within us. It's something it's almost linked. It might well be linked to the survival instinct, and it's that sense of must live at all costs. We must protect the self at all costs, and it's at this gut level we identify as me. So it's something that goes very, very deeply. So is there any? Just stop there if there's any questions or comments around any of that.
Are we not sort of biologically designed to have this protective sense of self to survive?
I think it's a good point, because I think you're right. It's something it's almost hardwired into us, and it's something that's very, very useful. I mean, you can imagine evolutionary, you know, if we were We want to protect ourselves from things that threaten us, and we want things that help us live. So,
I think we live in a very sort of privileged Western existence where we're not threatened on a daily basis. And so we can afford to be that the way you're describing, but is that not a bit of a luxury to this particular time and place?
It's interesting, Well, the Buddha lived in a very different circumstance. Mm. You know, he lived in quite a dangerous time. There were wild animals around, there was war, etc. I suppose, is it a luxury to live more life in an enriching way? I don't think so, but, yeah.
Well, I was thinking it might be that... Well, I was thinking there is a traditional teaching that does emphasise that we are very fortunate to live, you know, for example, in a place where there's no war. You know, well, I mean, that's obviously fortunate, isn't it? But I mean, from a dharmic point of view, there's a teaching called, I think it's the 8 or 10 endowments, you know, that we're not being threatened in that way. We have actually lived at a time where we can hear the Dharma, for example, because, you know, there's lots of places where they couldn't hear it, or we wouldn't be free to practice. Some countries today, we wouldn't be free to practice. So in a sense, if you want to call it a luxury, you can take that as a positive thing, think, well, given that I am so fortunate to be able to have this luxury, let's not throw it away, you know, can I take this deeper? So maybe thinking of it in terms, because luxury kind of a bit of a pejorative thing, can't it? But maybe if we thought of it, we are fortunate to be in a position to be able to, well, even have the leisure, if you like, to sit here, we're not out trying to just survive and so on.
Can I say something that just occurred to me in response to that? Is that it's not just your luxury. If you're already practicing and being more positive or whatever, other people might benefit without you even knowing. You might be having a luxurious experience, but someone else might just benefit from something you do in that state.
Yeah, thank you, Subhadramati. That was a helpful point. So the effect on it is that, and I think touching what you said, Jonathan, is that you become a force for good in the world. It's said that the flavour of pranya, the flavour of wisdom, is metta. So the two things are very, very much linked. And this is spontaneous, unbound matter of the enlightened mind of the Buddha. He's gone beyond the sense of self. He's left the self-centeredness behind, the self-orientation behind, and he just identifies with all life everywhere. So he naturally wants to help others. The enlightened mind naturally wants to help all life. Just in the same way that if you get a thorn in your hand, you would just pull the thorn out. Quite naturally, you wouldn't even think about it. You would not think, oh, I'm being compassionate to myself here. You just pull it out. In the same way that the Buddha does that, he doesn't think, oh, I'm going to be compassionate to all beings. He just acts very naturally there. And he just, it's just the way, the state that he's attained is just a natural way of acting. So this is something spontaneous, and it's something, well, even you know, give up, an enlightened person will kind of give up their life for, because there's no attachment to the body anymore. It's not got that sense that we generally have of trying to protect ourselves. And there's a very moving story from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and it's contained the second book, here we go, Tales of Freedom by Vasantra, and it's very, very, if you can get a copy of this book, it's an excellent book. He writes very, very well. So it was saying it's actually a true story from taken from a small Chinese town in the first half of the 19th century. He's talking about how a crowd had gathered round a street corner, and in the centre of the crowd there was a man there, and he was being tied to he was calling it a strange horse, not an animal of flesh and blood, but a horse made of copper. And the man is panicking, he's sweating, he's struggling, but he's being tied down to this. It turns out the man is a convicted thief, and it's hard to see why he's so frightened of this. The crowd around is jeering, but you notice when you look at it further, it's made of copper, it's hollowed out. And this is where, this is full of wood. And this is where lighted torch is going to be put. So he's going to be tortured and put to death for his crimes. You can understand why he's so scared. So the flaming torch has been lit by someone in the crowd and brought forward. And all of a sudden, an elderly man comes out of the crowd. And this is someone who's, he's not from the town. He's dressed in traditional Tibetan garb. And he suddenly announces that there's all been a mistake. And the thief is actually innocent and he did all the crimes. You know, the Tibetan is owning up to it. And suddenly the crowd turns on him and, you know, who is this stranger, who's this foreigner? And he gets taken and put on this horse. And the wood is lit. And this Tibetan sits on this horse, on this contraption. And instead of what you'd imagine of writhing in pain, he just sits bolt upright and looks out into the sky, completely still, completely focused, as the copper gets hotter and hotter. And he dies. So he's saying meanwhile, a couple of his friends are wondering where he is. And they go out looking for him, and they come across some of the crowd. And the crowd joyfully tell him what has happened. It turns out that this man was called Dola Jigme Khaltsang, and he was their beloved teacher. Someone who's believed to have attained a great degree of insight, if not enlightenment. And it was just like him when he was wandering, they'd just arrived in this Chinese town. And when he saw that this man was going to be tortured and put to death, his heart couldn't bear seeing that. And so he offered himself up instead. So this story just brings to light, just in quite a vivid way, you know, what someone will do, an enlightened person could do, because he's not got any attachment to his body, not got any attachment to his sense of self. He can just go into a deep, absorbed state of meditation. And so this isn't something, it's not martyrdom. He's not becoming a martyr for the Buddhist cause. He's just that he couldn't bear to see another suffering. And, I just find that a very moving tale of what is possible. Yeah. So it's a very lofty goal, pranya. But we can also have glimpses ourselves, and these glimpses can give us direction, they can spur us on and encourage us to practice. So many people have glimpses, and I think there's lots of different ways where we might have these glimpses. Maybe we have an experience in nature where we've been uplifted by nature, and these are glimpses or glimpses of glimpses of something more coming in. We're taken away from our self-preoccupied state and drawn into something a lot bigger. Wordsworth was quite famously drawn upwards, uplifted by his time walking in the Lake District, especially when he was a young man. And from the inspired state, he wrote some of his best poetry. And we might ourselves be uplifted. I've just spent the weekend in around the Derbyshire and around the Peak District, and just, you know, just the effect it has on in the countryside, kind of a very positive and uplifting effect. Or it might be other things. It might be art, music, poetry, literature, film, just reading a book. Might be something that just really strikes you and takes you out of yourself. You see something greater. You see life in a more richer, broader way. Or maybe it's death or illness. Maybe a close family member or friend has died or is ill. Or maybe your own sense of mortality. There was, I don't know if you've seen it, about getting on for 20 years ago, Dennis Potter got a terminal illness. He was a very famous English playwright. And he was interviewed, and it was around this time of year. And he knew, actually, he had only a few months to live. And he was describing the blossom, and he was saying it was the blossomest blossom you could imagine. And it's just this sense that this was going to be his last spring, and he realised that. And so he was drinking in everything, you know, he was really experiencing and really savouring everything, because he knew it would be his last time. Or maybe there's sometimes a sense of separation, you know, after a relationship splits up, or, you know, we haven't. This suddenness can have us a sense of impermanence. Or maybe we have something, a spontaneous sense of connection with life. And this can be to varying degrees. We can have something which is very strong within us, or something quite subtle. And I think it's probably the reason why we all come along. We all meditate. We're all looking for something, because we've had a glimpse. We've had a glimmer of something. Of something beyond our everyday state. I think that's probably the reason people come along. So what I'd like you to do is to pair up with someone and just spend a few minutes just thinking about, just talking about something that has uplifted you, taken you beyond yourself. And it might be one of these things. It might be nature. It might be a work of art. It might be some music. It might be a film you've seen. And just spend a few minutes each talking about that, just sharing your experience. So if you just turn to someone near you and just spend a few minutes.
I'm going to go to the next one.
And if you swap over, if you haven't swapped over, keep talking. Very good, send lots of energy. Just wondering if anyone would like to share any thoughts and other experiences.
Yeah, I'd like to say mine. Mm. I just want to say it because it was really amazing. Mm. My what was up lifting? What was down lifting?
Yeah.
So I spoke to my brother yesterday. He said that his daughter. He said to him, she's 7 years old. That she said to him, "Oh, Daddy, I'm a vegetarian now." And I last saw her at Christmas, and I think it was Christmas, and I'd forgotten that she asked me why I'm a vegetarian. Mm. I said to her, I just don't want to eat anything with a face. So that's one of the things I said to her. And Danny told me, he says, "Oh, Warren, oh, you know," and so he asked her why she's a vegetarian. She says, "Oh, Daddy, I don't eat anything now with a face." My father told me that last night. I'll tell you what, I was just completely over the. I was uplifted. I was so happy, really happy. And then I considered about, you know, about her. I mean, about her mum. I mean, perhaps, you know, perhaps it's going to be tricky for her, or it's going to be difficult for her. Mm. And so I reflected on that a bit. Mm. But it was amazing. I was just saying to Jason, it was just an amazing thing.
Mm. You've had a really positive effect. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if that's going to have a really positive effect on me. It was just a real instant.
Of somebody else, yeah.
But I just felt really happy for a short while.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
We were just talking about those little things when you're in public. Places in living in a big city, and we were just talking about moments in public transport. You had an experience where you made eye contact through a dog, and I was talking about making eye contact with someone through someone's children. And we both looked at the other person and smiled.
Ah, yeah.
You both know what you're smiling about. If a little kid had said something, the dog was very affectionate. And you just make contact with a stranger, and you haven't even said anything, but you feel like you're not alone in the big city anymore.
Yeah.
It's really lovely.
I like that. It's really good because quite often I find that on the public transport I can just be really in my own world, you know, in my own thoughts. And it's lovely to be able to sort of step out of that and connect.
I was just sharing about how, like, you know, in a city like London, you see loads of, like, pretty much it's all about humans and buildings, but then. It's amazing how you can see life just popping out from any corner possible. For example, you see like weeds or like flowers coming out like cracks in the wall.
Yeah.
And that's that's a really beautiful thing because everything's really striving to live in.
Yes.
It's not like, oh, it's weed, you need to clear it. It's not like that.
No.
It's everything's trying to.
You can really see the life trying to come through, even. Lovely.
Yeah, I certainly, I mentioned that I experienced some of my most uplifting moments through music. I perform music myself, but not so much when I'm performing, but more when I'm listening to something that I've loved for a long time.
Yeah.
So Beethoven's Ninth Symphony or
something.
Sometimes it just lifts you right out of yourself.
And yes.
A sense of expansion is incredible.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, I agree. I find that very much myself from listening to types of music. It's almost like you're taken somewhere else. You're transported into another dimension even.
I was discussing things with him. I said that I can lose myself walking along the canal towpath. Very often, I'll arrive somewhere without really remembering how I got there. You just keep walking, and you're completely in a different world. You can lose everything. It's quite amazing.
You're really absorbed in the what's around you.
been quite getting into the sky lately, because a few months ago I moved into an attic room with three windows, so I've got like three sloping walls. And there's a window in each wall. And basically the sun rises above this window, which is above my bed, and kind of swings around the whole of my room and sets out of my kitchen window, which is in the same room, I guess, a studio. But it's really nice because about 7 in the morning, I wake up looking at the sun because it's beaming straight onto where I sleep. So I get woken up by the sun, and when I look over to my right, that's the main window, and I just get this view of the sky. Because I can only really see the sky. I mean, it's air low, and if I stand on my tiptoes, I can see out. But if I'm sitting down or lying down, all I can see out of the windows is the sky. And this incredible view across London, because I'm on Telegraph Hill in South London, so you just get this incredible... And it's also in the night, when it's a clear night, the moonlight will fill my whole room. Because it's come straight through this really big Velux window. And obviously it's blue. It's starting to be blue. But even when it's been snowing or really heavy rain, like it's been some incredibly dramatic skies lately. And it's just this incredible sense of being what kind of like on the roof of the world.
You can really feel part of nature or feel like nature's a lot bigger somehow. I think we can often feel that on retreats, can't we? That where we go on retreat and then when we've been meditating, our mind is stilled. We can just be more appreciative of beauty and more appreciative of the nature around us. I was thinking on my last solitary, I was watching the moon every night when it was visible, and just seeing the phases of the moon, and just being entranced by the moon, really.
And I have another thing I could share.
Great, sure.
I used to hate coriander.
Thank you.
Coriander, and then there was one time I was like speaking to coriander, and then I read something about the hate. For example, I hate coriander. That's just me sort of labelling something, and I can label it something else. For example, and with all things really, like for example, we can say, oh, we hate the cold weather, we hate the rain, we hate traffic jams, but then it's just the type of emotion that you are giving out to whatever that is. That's your kind of label for that thing. And it's just a matter of changing it and trying to appreciate it for what it is. For example, the coriander. There was one time I was having some noodles and they had like a whole heap of raw, fresh coriander, just like a whole heap of it on top of the noodles.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, I'd give this a try and then really try to taste what it was.
Yes, it was actually quite nice. I think that's a really good point, isn't it? Because you know, we've got an idea about ourselves, or I don't like coriander, I don't like tomatoes or whatever it is, and then you know, we've got all these likes and dislikes that we believe in, but actually if we step past that, then maybe it's just been a belief all along, and we can just be open to a new experience. Sometimes we need to step into this open, the unknown sometimes, whether it's coriander or, going on a retreat, into this open dimension of being, this sort of openness to experience, and just see what happens. I think it's a really good point.
And it does really make me think, I don't want to go off too much of a tangent, but it makes me think that, you know, someone that you really love and you have an argument with them, and suddenly, where did that go? You just hate them. And it comes back again, but it's incredible.
Yeah.
You're in that state of mind.
Yeah,
you need to find that coriander moment.
Well, one of my best friends in Sweden, the first time I met him, I decided I don't like this guy at all. I thought we would never be friends. And now, over the years, he's become one of my best friends. So my first, I judged too quickly.
Interesting. So really good. Yeah, really good. How we can, well, we all have experiences where we can sort of be open up into the unknown, you know, into the new, into the possibility. One way of moving forward, if you like, of treading the path, is to open ourselves up to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, to their qualities. We might want to read the life story of the Buddha and find out who he was and be allow that to affect us, or allow the Buddha to have an effect on us. We might want to do puja, where we do Buddhist ritual, and again enter into a devotional spirit, and again see the more we bring the qualities of the Buddha to mind, the more we become like the Buddha. And we can take a step, an inch or two further towards his experience. We might chant mantras. These are symbols. This is why symbols, you know, we might have visual symbols, for instance, the Buddha statue, the Buddha Rupa here, but also a mantra is a sound symbol. So these are all symbols where we're really trying to engage the imagination. It's the imagination that will let us go towards the enlightenment experience. Poetry, myth are all very helpful. And well, what I thought we'd do is just do a little imaginative exercise. So if you get into your meditation postures, we're going to do just a period of recollecting the Buddha. I'm going to lead you through this. So settling into your posture and just again becoming aware of yourself, relaxing into yourself. Becoming aware of your body and how you are at the moment. Sounds around you. Then I'm going to invite you to come on a journey back in time 2,500 years ago to the time of the Buddha. And you're in northern India, walking in the twilight down a forest path, and you can feel the air around you is warm, and you can smell the forest, the earth, the trees, and it's a moonlit night, the full moon. And you come across a moonlit glade, and you notice there's people there. These are the followers of the Buddha, monks and nuns, sitting in meditation, wearing yellow robes made of rags, sitting very still. One of them notices you and beckons you over to sit by him. So you sit in meditation posture and look around the glade. And as you look around, you notice one particular man more than the rest. He's somehow poised and dignified, sitting very still. Something a bit mysterious about him. and you feel a palpable sense of love and kindness emanating from him. Somehow you know that he's aware of you. He sees you in your depths and in your heights. He's pleased to see you. There's a warmth and kindness and a welcome. So you close your eyes and you feel yourself uplifted, transported, experiencing something completely new. You feel your body totally relax, deeply. Feeling a deep sense of contentment. It feels like your mind is clearing. Beginning to see things more clearly. You find yourself opening up. A sense of wonder and awe to the mystery of life. You get a glimpse of what the Buddha knows. Your doubts drop away, and so does your fear. Enter a sense of timelessness, stillness.
the vision begins to fade. You find yourself sitting back here at the Buddhist center, but still with a sense of having met the Buddha. Okay, so we'll bring the class to an end here. So I hope to see you next week, where Subhadramati will be going further into the super personal force. Thank you.
Thank you.